Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
Well, you can laugh. It was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm down Swanfield, and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawny man?
There was a moment during the era of behind closed doors football when I began to wonder, are the supporters really all they're cracked up to be? It was Sunday, October 4th, 2020. Aston Villa just put the champions Liverpool to the sword 7-2 on the same day that Spurs put 6 past Man United at Old Trafford. It was a glorious, bonkers day of football, players celebrating wildly. The thought crossed my mind, football without fans, is it all that bad? By the end of last season, that thought had long since departed my brain. The fans of the Euros then reminded everyone what it's all about. And then we get to the opening weekend of the new Premier League season. Intense, emotional, wonderful, and largely because of the reactions of the people in the stands. So it's official. Football fans, actually quite important. Welcome to your second Captain's Football Podcast. First one of the season. Hi, Ken. Hi, Murph.
Owen, how are you?
Hey, Owen, how are you?
I'm great.
Man
I'm
of very, the people. Very, very much sounding like a man of the people this morning. I love to hear it.
Salt of the earth, the football fan. Well, you know, how could I can't believe that my faith in football sport wavered at any point. I mean, it's pretty stupid. There just were a lot of goals that one day back
7-2,
in October last
7-2
year.
Was a lot of fun, to be fair.
Football is a nut.
I was just thinking, there's a lot of fun. And would these goals all have gone? Would this have gone the same way? Are the fans maybe holding teams back? And no, it turns out they're actually probably making teams better when they're in there. Certainly for Brentford, like their manager Thomas Frank conducting the crowd in a rendition of Hey Jude after they'd beaten Arsenal. Tears streaming down the face of an elderly fan. There was just so, everywhere you looked, there was emotion pouring out. The lads sprinting on the pitch to celebrate Doucouré's goal for Everton against Southampton. I thought that was great. Nobody seems to care about pitch invasions. Used to be this big thing. Oh, that's terrible. They're going to be banned for life.
Ah, you love to see it now.
You love to see them running on.
Woody it all
absolute
in.
Massive security concern, sure. But, you know, they're just having a good time. You know, emotion has gotten the better of them. So I just thought so much. I just felt really good about the Premier League weekend during it. From the Brentford game set a good tone. And everything after that, not everything after that was amazing, but certainly I enjoyed it all, I must say. And I don't know, am I the only one here? I'm feeling pretty good about the football. You guys?
Brentford, good. Big teams smash tiny teams for Saturday, but, you know, kind of entertainingly.
I even enjoyed it. Yeah, I even enjoyed that. I know I won't if it keeps happening.
And Spurs City was pretty funny.
Ken?
Yeah, I agree. I'm in agreement with everything.
Oh, okay. Since you were saying, remarkably quiet. I don't care. I mean, if you didn't enjoy anything, that's just fine as well. I mean, you know, a point of difference is no problem at all at the start of the show. Just thought I might be shooting on my own there. Richie's in for our first show of the new campaign with John Bruin. We've got more football podcasts during the week, but only if you're a World Service member. Also for members, tomorrow, Tuesday, the best GA analysis team in the business, Ushie McConville and Paul Flynn, will go big on Mayo's big day at Croker. And we'll get reaction from Mayo as well. Secondcaptains.com, £5 a month plus VAT is all it costs to sign up. And there's no minimum contract or anything like that. So if you want to sign up for the first month of the new Premier League season, you can do that and then decide at the end of August or maybe the end of September or just keep it ticking over after that. We're going to put another pod out today, by the way, on the Mayo win, one that will be available to everybody. That's just once myself and Ken have had time to get our heads right. Apparently there's a view out there among some World Service members that humble pie needs to be devoured. So we'll have
humble
to think
pie.
Yeah. Well, by who? My part. Well, by me, anyway.
Fine.
We'll get to this, Ken. That's for the other podcast.
Yeah, don't worry. Don't you worry your little head about it, Ken. You've got some football to report on.
Yeah, we're doing a podcast today about that. We're doing a podcast tomorrow about that. There'll be plenty of time to discuss whether or not Humble Pies should be on the menu. And that one today will be available to everyone. But to listen to Oisin and Paul Flynn tomorrow, you got to sign up, baby. Why did I say it like that? Report on sport, please, Ken.
Yeah, and I agree with all the things you were saying about the fans being important. I mean, the main reason why you need the fans, you know, is to kind of feel as though you're not the only person watching the game. you know, it's sort of, you know, a big crowd just creates the impression, wow, everybody in the world is watching this game, which is also inaccurate, but it is a nicer feeling to have as you sit there idling away the precious minutes. Your precious minutes that you have here on this planet, watching, you know, watching Tottenham against Man City, which was a fine way to spend those couple of hours. I thought Nuno Espirito Santo joins Jurgen Klopp, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, and Jose Mourinho on three Premier League victories against Pep Guardiola.
Yeah.
Obviously, previously he had a couple of Adama Traore inspired wins with Wolves, and now a Son inspired win against Pep. And this is one of the most, I don't want to say comfortable wins, because Man City, you know, still sort of edged it on the balance of chances and, you know, XG and whatnot. You know, you could replay the game, you could see how City could have won that game. But it certainly wasn't a situation where, oh, Spurs have really snatched that win. It was like a game that Raheem Sterling said the most accurate thing about the game. He said afterwards, "We let them do exactly what they wanted." Mm. And you're like, that's exactly what happened. And I thought it was quite a pointed comment from Sterling, actually. Well, I just thought, you know, like he kind of, it was an indictment really of City's tactical approach. It was like, we let them do exactly what they wanted. And should they have been doing that? Probably not.
I presume the way Sterling means that, though, is we let them, as players, we let them dictate, as opposed to our manager sent us out with shy tactics and we let them do what they wanted.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like the manager, like what, if you look at the tactics, what were the tactics? The tactics essentially were that Ferran Torres played up front. Ferran Torres is not a bad player. Mm-hmm. But would Gabriel Jesus not have been a better option for that role? Might Kevin De Bruyne have been a better option? You know, De Bruyne, both of those players that I've mentioned came on in the game. Now, I'm assuming that they were left out because of some sort of, oh, you know, minutes, blah, blah, you know, they're not fit, etc. But I do sort of wonder, like, I mean, you know, you've already lost 3 points. You know, you've lost your first game. This isn't the Community Shield, you know. I mean, City have lost their last three matches, if you go back to the Champions League final, 1-0. So they're having a bit of a problem scoring goals. And I mean, the problem that Guardiola mentioned afterwards was transitions. You know, we're not good on transitions, and it was clear that Tottenham were looking for those moments and exploited them throughout the game. I mean, that's what Sterling is saying when he said, you know, we did what they wanted. City moved slowly up the field, slowly moved the ball around in front of Tottenham. In front of their box, and then lost the ball, and Tottenham quickly up the field, bang bang. That was basically the pattern of the game. That's what Tottenham wanted. It was a move just of that nature that brought their goal, and that was a goal that you could see coming because it was a situation that had already occurred a number of times in the match, and for various reasons, Spurs making a mess of their finishing. They hadn't managed to score until then, and then it continued to happen afterwards. I mean, Bergwijn had a great chance. Yeah. Bergwijn's chance that he missed was a clearer chance than Son's one that he scored. And again, it was a similar situation where one runner, Lucas Moura, he caused such problems. I mean, was there four Man City players around him? I mean, eventually it was actually Fernandinho and Ruben Dias who managed between them to... Fernandinho tackled it, and Ruben Dias stretched out a leg and passed it to Bergwijn. You know, and you saw how how City could turn effectively a 2-on-4 situation into a 1-on-1. Mm. Or Tottenham, rather, could turn. And so this is pretty bad from City. Okay, it's the first game of the season. Everyone's entitled to be a bit rusty. But, what are they going to actually do about this? We got an email, Owen, I think, about Harry Kane. Do you have that email there?
Here it is now. Hi, guys. It's from Tommy McGregor. Watching the Spurs game, I found myself asking a question as Spurs went 1-0 up. Does Harry Kane want Spurs to win this match? And then I wonder what his reaction to the goal was. We'll be keen to hear your opinions on this one. Also, what impact, if any, this result will have on the Kane transfer saga. Hope you're all well. From Tom in Street, Somerset. We're going to talk in more detail about Kane and what's been going on there with John and Richie. But what about that email again?
I think Harry Kane would only have cared about the result of the match insofar as it affects the chances of him being able to move from Tottenham to Manchester City. And in those circumstances, I think Tottenham winning was actually the better result from Harry Kane's point of view.
Oh, because Spurs feel now they might be able to go on without him.
Well, Spurs have seen that they can go on without him. I mean, of course they can go on without him. I mean, he's just one, like, overrated player. You know, I mean, he's a good player, but he is overrated, you know, by virtue of being the England captain and, you know, having had so many great seasons for Spurs in the past, you know, but past performances, no
guarantee. Being last season being one of them. I don't know about this overrated tag.
Yeah, you know, I mean, he got...
Well, he might be overvalued.
I find in our... Any Irish football fan, like just Irish people talking about Harry Kane, I don't know. It seems like a different player. I think even go back a few years, I think we've struggled to, this is a sweeping generalization, but there's kind of a sense, is he really all that? Whereas in England, it's like they look at his number. Obviously, they get overexcited because he's English as well. But they look at his numbers of goals and assists on a practically annual basis. And I think with justification, point out that he's actually a really, really, really good player.
No, I mean, he is a really good player.
You, in this case, Ken, refuse to accept that.
No, he is. I think he's a really good player as well, but I think he's an overrated player. You know, he's really good, but I don't think he's like a £160 million player.
That's not overrated, necessarily.
Yeah. Don't they mean more or less the same thing?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so, actually, funnily enough. I think, like, or you're overvalued is you're paying a premium because he's English. Overrated is just purely to do with what he does on the pitch. And to be fair, I think his numbers suggest that he is an exceptional footballer. But yeah, maybe he's a 100 million footballer as opposed to a 160 million euro footballer.
Well, I think his really phenomenal numbers were, you know, between 2014 and 2018. You know, and we're in 2021 now. And, yeah, you know, okay.
Well, 23 goals last season in the Premier League and a load of assists.
Yeah.
That's not bad.
Yeah, no, it's not bad. It's not bad.
And his so-called fallow years, I know you're not calling that, were still scoring 17 and 18 goals.
Yeah. Look, okay. You know, I mean, maybe I've overstepped the mark there, Owen. You've done a good job of defending Harry Kane. You know, there's a reason, I suppose, why City are chasing him. And I just felt as though this game...
New season, new Ken there, isn't it?
Yeah, very polite. Wow, very polite Ken Hurdy. Yeah. This is strange.
I respect your opinion.
You know, again, he hasn't even played, you know. It's not like I'm criticising him on the basis of a bad performance. Mm. You know, I'm just sort of saying, look, well, it began with that question of whether Tottenham could go on without him. Of course they can. You know, I mean, they've maybe the players that they've got would do better in Kane's absence. I mean, an interesting player to look at Tottenham this season, I think, is Dele Alli. You know, can he recover as a sort of a footballer? I mean, he went totally belly up, I guess, over the last couple of seasons.
Did I forget Dele Alli was at the club until I saw him pop up yesterday? Yes, I did.
You know, maybe he can. This creates a bit of space for him to reassert himself. I'm talking about Kane's transfer, which hasn't happened yet and may not yet happen. But I thought that the game showed why City really actually quite need Harry Kane, or if not Harry Kane, then somebody a bit like him to play centre forward. Because how else are they going to approach these games where everybody is going to do exactly what Tottenham did to them? Everybody's going to say, oh, well, you know, we've seen City with all their great, you know, attacking midfielders, you know, and your Ferran Torres's, your Riyad Mahrez's, your Kevin De Bruyne is, your Jack Grealish is, you know, they're all great players just outside the box. And What do they have in the box? Not a lot. Sterling. You know, Jesus, who's probably on the bench. You know, I think that there's an obvious incentive for teams then to take the approach that was so successful for Spurs, to say, okay, well, let's see what you can do. Let's see if you can break us down. Because we saw City yesterday, okay, this is a team that's in the early stages, but this is their second game, second defeat, second time failing to score. And second time looking a little bit confused. You know, we've done everything here to get into the final third. Now what do we do? Mm-hmm. Like, who are we looking for here? Like, what's the next step? Now, if Harry Kane is in the team, that simplifies all that. You know, and you've got a player who's able to put away crosses for a start, and is able to shoot from unexpected positions, and generally is able to do all these sort of centre forward things, but also to provide, you know, as they often talk about centre forwards in Spain, a reference point is to me what City seem to be lacking.
That's a great phrase,
reference point. You know, there he is, there's our man. I mean, you could say target man, but target man carries with it the implication of, you know, a guy who you target with 65 yards
from a great distance.
Yeah
Someone you and can that's see not from 80 yards away. Basically,
that's not really what we're talking about here. We're talking about like an attacking focal point. It's not as though City couldn't play without a striker. It's just that I'm not sure they're currently at the level where they can really reliably do that. I mean, you know, someone who is great at that, and I know that he's somebody who in the past we've had our disagreements about, is David Silva.
Put some respect on my name.
But this is one thing that David Silva was good
oh
at.
Oh my
doing.
God, this is unbelievable. What a honestly, start to the season.
Sorry, can we get Ken back on the line here? I don't know who this imposter is.
I think I'm going to cancel my own World Service subscription at this, because I don't know. I don't know if again, I like this new Ken.
But like,
at all.
There seems to be this real, like, you know, misunderstanding around the word overrated. You know, and I think David Silva was an overrated player. But I'm not saying that David Silva was not a good player. I just don't think he was. I think that this originally arose because somebody, possibly Roy Smith, had described him as the greatest foreign player to play in the Premier League. Which
Graham Souness had said something similar at the time.
Yeah, which is like so obviously ridiculous that it demands a reaction. But David Silva was good at this, at knowing, you know, when to run forward, when to come back to create space for another player to run forward. He's really good at this. And currently City don't have somebody who's able to make it work the way that Silva did for them for many years, that type of thing. And Grealish, maybe, you know, Grealish has phenomenal ability, but this is a much more complicated situation for him than Aston Villa, where it was simple. It was like, you are the genius, here's the ball, now give it to Ollie Watkins. You know what I mean? It's like, couldn't have been easier in a way. I mean, he managed it brilliantly, but this is kind of like, we say the team is a star at Man City, but really Pep's the star. We know that. The team is supposed to be what's the interplay is where the creativity comes from, rather than from the genius imagination of one player. You know what I mean? So this is what Grealish has to sort of integrate himself into. And I just feel as though that might be a little bit easier if he did have someone he could cross the ball to from time to time, as opposed to going, okay, I've got the ball. He just kept getting the ball in bad situations, I felt. You know, it's like, okay, he's got it. The Tottenham defense is set. Tanganga is already advancing towards him to club him to the ground, right? Which Tanganga did so many times. How he didn't get booked for so long. Like, the referee kept coming over to him and saying, listen, I can't have you doing that. Like, every time you get the ball and then bang, does a City player hits the ground like a sack of potatoes. And it's like, you can't do that. Although, of course, the referees are letting it go now. Maybe that's one of the reasons, Owen, why you felt so good about the Premier League. You were enjoying the implementation of VAR.
You know what? I was enjoying it so much, Ken, I barely noticed it.
Yeah, well, I did notice it. I thought, what are they doing here? Like, this is quite different. Everybody was saying, we're enjoying the way VAR is being used. Which is to say, they're not really using it now, or... Like, well, it's common sense. We're bringing common sense back into decision making. And so what does this mean in practice? Well, it means that we don't show replays anymore of controversial incidents. We don't award penalties anymore. And we don't disallow goals for offside anymore. It's a totally new system. We saw goals scored that looked offside, but there was not even a replay of that. Like, not even the sort of replay you used to get in the pre-VAR days, where it's like suspicion of offside there. You know, where they'd say that, and it would never matter because the goal had already been given. We saw penalties that weren't given, which looked like penalties. Again, not even replays. We saw a penalty that wasn't a penalty given to West Ham, but nothing was said about it. So I thought, okay, this is obviously less interventionist, but it's also more mysterious and confusing. Like, at what level is a little foul not okay anymore? Like, at what level do the, you know what I mean? It's like, I was watching with a friend who said, oh yes, it's the common sense surveillance state. You know, we've got like 100% surveillance, but we're going to apply common sense, which is to say arbitrary judgment to different situations. You know, it's like we have evidence of a foul, but on this occasion we're like, we don't feel like giving that penalty. But on another day, you know, it's going to be, oh, well, look, there's contact. You know, so this is what's... It seems to me as though they were recoiling from the obvious absurdity of VAR, you know, where you're disallowing things or giving penalties, for instance, for increasingly minor, like verging on invisible infractions, but without sort of actually following through to a logical conclusion. Okay, let's just get rid of this thing. They've still got it in their back pocket, and it will be taken out of the back pocket to be inflicted on a game in a baffling manner at some point. But look, again, let's not talk about that. What were we talking about?
I saw Jamie Carragher had took one of his pre-season trips to Stockley Park, as he did before it was first implemented 2 seasons ago. And he said, what I like this time is their attitude is different. When I went in there two seasons ago, it felt as though they thought they knew better than all the other competitions that had implemented VAR, and they were going to do it better. Whereas now they've accepted that actually he was very good at the Euros and elsewhere, and they're going to be really good. Now, he was saying that. I remember Carragher and Neville arriving back from VAR the first time, and they'd been drinking the Kool-Aid. They thought, this is great. Yeah, they're really talking sense, these guys.
This is what's happened every time. It's like the greater the time distance between actually meeting the refs, as the longer that goes on, the less inclined they are to give them a fair shout. You know, like there was like 3 or 4 weeks after they'd gone the first time where it was like, to be honest, I don't see any mistakes being made here. They're all brilliant and so brave, by the way.
Is their humility.
Yeah.
You know, they've accepted they don't know best. So maybe it is just going to be that we're not really going to enforce the rules. I mean, you know, it's every season has a new theme.
Listen, it's a vibe. Know? Let's just go with it, you know?
Yeah. So look, as for City, right? So City, again, this may sound a bit doomy. It's like, come on, it's just the first game. It's just a question of getting back in their stride. But remember the stride from last season. This is going to be an interesting question now to watch City. They won the league with 83 points, which is the lowest since 2016, which obviously was Leicester, in a season when the big clubs all kind of did a beached whale on it. And Leicester were able to win the league with 81 points. The second place team had 71 points that season, which is just awful. You know what I mean? Like, it's a really weak performance by the rival teams. But City, obviously, I don't think City can win the league with 83 points again this time. And I think this is going to be a different kind of football this season than the pandemic ball that they proved themselves to be the best at. You know, I think they're going to be up against stronger, faster teams that have actually had pre-seasons, teams that have had some time to train and to organize. You know, I mean, I thought Tottenham gave a good demonstration of that yesterday. You know, look what three fast forwards who have some idea of how to, you know, how to coordinate their attacking movements. Look at the damage that can do against City. Which team in the Premier League doesn't have three fast forwards who can play this way? Mm-hmm. You know, there's actually very few at this point. So I think it's going to be difficult unless they radically improve from what we saw against Tottenham.
It's not just the general depth. It's also the teams they're up. Liverpool are in much better shape than they were last year with the players back, and Chelsea look compared to this time last year when we weren't sure. Well, actually, they started last season pretty well, didn't they? I think before it went off.
They don't have Frank Lampard.
They don't. Yeah, exactly. Right, and they've got Lukaku to come in, and they were really good the other day. Like, you know, we on Premier Sports, both Damien Delaney and Richard Dunne before the match said they're going to win the title. And interestingly, on Match of the Day, Alan Shearer and Ian Wright both tipped Chelsea as well. So I was kind of wasn't quite sure where all this... I tipped them last weekend, so...
Yeah.
But I was kind of surprised everyone seems to be going for them at the moment.
Well, I think it's almost a process of elimination. Nobody's that impressed by City at the moment. Now, and again, you know, Kane arrives at City and that just changed things a bit. But you can see that City have some weaknesses. When you saw Chelsea, Manchester United and Liverpool all looked strong, fast, you know, full of energy in these games. Now, it's early days. You wait to see what happens when a bunch of players get injured and so on and so forth. But City didn't really radiate those types of qualities. So I think people are going, well, okay, City are the champions. You know, they are the sort of, they're the expected winner. They were odds-on favourites to win the title at the beginning of this round of games. They're not anymore. They're a little bit above evens now. But, you know, that reflected the fact that, okay, they've got the most expensive squad. They're smashing the transfer record again. They're probably going to buy more players. And yet, there's something not that impressive about them. Chelsea, of course, beat them in the Champions League final. Chelsea have got a coach who seems really on top, particularly of the defensive side of the game. That, you know, they were impossible to score against after Tuchel took over. Unless you were CR7, Callum Robinson, who isn't in the league this year. And to this really solid defensive base, and you know, midfield wise, they've got your European champion Jorginho, Kante, who everyone was saying should be the Ballon d'Or, you know, until the Euros or whatever. You know, Kovacic, Mason Mount, you know, who walks on water, as we know, and then you've got like this fantastic selection of wingers, you know. Pulisic, Ziyech, I suppose, is injured. And then Lukaku added to all of this. Like, okay, I mean, I've talked myself into saying they're the favourites myself. I mean, who are the other contenders? Liverpool, who have proven that they can do it, but they're trying to do it again with virtually the same team, it seems like. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they look fresh and enthusiastic at the weekend.
They did. But I think it does reflect that sort of sense of, is this Liverpool team a bit stale? You know, it's going to be interesting to see how they do. Players like Mane and Firmino were really poor last season. Do they have it in them to sort of come back? Was it just a case of exhaustion, too many seasons, you know, kind of running into each other? And now that they've had a break, are they going to be better? You know, maybe they will. Will Virgil be? I thought Van Dijk looked a bit rusty. You know, he didn't quite look as. I mean, it's natural for a guy who's back after nearly a year. To still be sort of feeling his way back in. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see if he is kind of the same very physically dominant player that he was before he got injured. So people with all those questions over Liverpool, and then with Manchester United haven't come close. I know they finished second last season, but they weren't really close to challenging for the title. There was a point in January when they were top of the league, but they very quickly faded away. And there's a sense that can Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, you know, if Chelsea and Manchester United have got roughly similar, you know, squads, or Chelsea squad is a bit better, and you know, Chelsea have won the Champions League and have kind of proven themselves as a team that's capable of winning big trophies. And then, you know, one of them is managed by Tuchel and the other by Solskjaer. Well, which are you going to favour, really? But you know, United again looked really good. Like they were up against Leeds. Leeds are a team that allow you to score many beautiful sweeping goals. You know, it gives them almost as much pleasure as it gives you. Because they just aren't interested in defending the centre. Like watching that game, it was like every time Man United win the ball, like in the Leeds half, it's like they're one pass away from a one-on-one. It's like Leeds, why you're gonna have to get on top of this situation. You have to make them more than one pass away from a one-on-one. You've got to do something about this. But like Leeds, obviously. Are doing things. I just feel as though maybe the approach was too pure.
Yes, possibly. That's what Bielsa's all about. So yeah,
I know, but you know, at the same time, okay, it was 6-2 last season, 5-1 this season. Actually, there's not much difference between those score lines, and I'm sure Leeds will have better days. But it was a little bit concerning from United's point of view, though. The second goal. Well, I mean, it's hard to pick a. There were so many good goals. It's really hard to pick one. But I think probably the second goal. Were Pogba's instant pass to Greenwood. And the really impressive thing about that was Greenwood's control at the speed he was running at. Like, because he's absolutely galloping onto the ball. He's trying to get away. I think it's Struyck is the defender. And he's trying to stay ahead of him. And he's, you know, he's really running close to top speed. But the control when he runs onto the ball, like the ball is goes barely any distance from his foot. You know what I mean? It was really impressive. And then obviously the goalkeeper. The first time I saw this goal, I thought, what has the goalkeeper done here? But it was really only in the replays that I thought, actually the goalkeeper, Messi, I remember my goalkeeper of the year last year.
Oh, yeah. I see your boy Soucek got a goal as well, Ken. But anyway, back to Medley.
He did. Michael Antonio couldn't score the penalty. But I thought Michael Antonio was really good, though. He did everything else he did in the game was amazing. Mm-hmm. His goal was one of the best goals of the weekend, I thought. Did you see? He won the header, like holds off a player, lays it off, then runs 60 yards to leave his markers. Like, oh no, he's going to make that run. Oh no. And then gets the ball back and whacks it in. With the air of a man determined to make up for his penalty miss a couple of minutes earlier. Mm-hmm. But
Melier you were talking about, yeah.
Yeah, I thought that what he was doing was actually challenging Greenwood to find the corner that Greenwood actually did find. Because the ball, I think, went in off the post. And Greenwood is a player who likes the near post finish as well. So Melier was kind of, okay, he's thinking, you're running really fast. Let's see what kind of shot you can come up with here. I'm going to stand up, force you to find the corner, and if you go for the near post, I'll be ready for that. So actually, it was, I think, probably quite a good decision in terms of how to stop the shot. And of course, Greenwood just finds the far corner. And it's difficult actually to see how he could have saved it. If he had anticipated the shot, maybe he could have, but it was pretty much a perfect finish. So, I mean, this is the thing about Manchester United, like, and it's kind of this similar thing that you got in a lot of their games last season, which is that they don't need to really dominate the game to score a lot of goals. You know, like the game against Leeds. Leeds had just got back into the game. Remember, it was an amazing goal by Ayling just after half time, and it's a sense that okay, this goal is going to change the pattern of the game. Leeds are back in this because they've been fairly in it in the first half. They'd had a fair few chances, and you know this is going to be difficult. United are in a difficult situation now, and then bang bang, two goals. It reminded me of a lot of their away matches last season. You know when they would go behind and then just start scoring. And, you know, it's not like City where you know, City like to really dominate the game. With United, it's kind of almost, they're quite happy to not do that. And in a way, it makes it easier for them to score the type of goals that they score. You know, if there is a little bit of space, if it's more of an end-to-end game. So this was exactly, I suppose, what they would have wanted. And I think it shows that they have the quality of player to I mean, why can't they win most of their Premier League games in this manner?
Oh, yeah.
Other teams are maybe going to make it more difficult than Leeds did, but they do have a lot of quality. I mean, I look at the front line and I think you'd actually wonder how Marcus Rashford is going to get in the team when he's back. Mm. You know, because they have Sancho, who obviously started on the bench. You would imagine a player who's arrived for £75 million or whatever is going to play most of the games. You've got Cavani, who was kind of the first choice centre forward towards the end of the season. Pogba, who seems to play on the left in big matches, on the left of the front three rather than in midfield. So, and then you've got Greenwood. So, it's and I haven't even mentioned, you know, the likes of Anthony Martial. So, yeah, it's they do have a lot of options, and I think you're looking good. One other thing I want to mention here, Owen, was I mean, there was a few things. There was obviously Rafa getting off to a good start. Which was nice. And the Everton, you know, it seemed like the Goodison crowd actually was sort of on Rafa's side, as opposed to going, oh, this guy, you know, it's disgusting. You know, if you looked at, like, the internet, you might think it was... I mean, okay, maybe if Everton had lost that game.
Yeah, they're on his side when they come from behind and win 3-1.
When you win 3-1 and score
nice
goals.
I would say it started well, though. You know, he came out, he got a nice ovation. You know, that's they gave him that at least. I mean, that ovation could have been much more of a, well, let's just wait and see how this game goes there, Rafa.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that's good. The other thing was just Shane Duffy. He was back in the Brighton team, which I don't know if people were necessarily expecting, given the way that Brighton seemed to sort of dispense with him. But just listen to his quotes. I mean, the Brighton website just has some quotes from him. And he's talking about, you know, I've missed that feeling of playing for Brighton, getting 3 points, giving Dunkey and Webby a big hug at the final whistle. It was such a great feeling. I mean, obviously Brighton had Ben White, who has joined Arsenal and was immediately being castigated by Jamie Carragher for being weak in the air. And did Carragher say something like, I was so relieved Liverpool didn't buy him or something like that?
Did he? I'd missed that.
Yeah, I think he was sort of like, oh, I heard Liverpool were interested, so I was relieved when Arsenal signed him. You know, it's like, harsh enough.
Ouch.
But you know, on the basis that Carragher's point essentially was that, yeah, he's like a footballing defender who's about the same size as me, and as opposed to, you know, really a dominant player like the Giants he was playing with, one of whom, of course, wasn't Shane Duffy, who was on his loan to Celtic, which was a disaster all round. But Shane Duffy says, it feels like I've come home. It's a special club for me. I miss being here too much. I wanted to come back. This club means a lot in my heart. I'm never going to give up, and until I'm told otherwise, I'm going to keep fighting till the last day. The club's been brilliant, even when they knew I was having a difficult spell on and off the pitch at Celtic. They were always in contact, seeing how I was. I still don't know exactly what the manager wants. He needed me on Saturday, I was there for him, but he has been great with me. So he's basically saying, it was a big weight off my shoulders and I came back. When you hit rock bottom, that is the reality check. A lot was going wrong off the field, which is difficult for me. I had to get through that. That was tough mentally. I wonder what he means when he talks about rock bottom. After the year I had, I was in a really low place. I thought the Premier League was probably over for me, but I've got good people around me, not the club. The club is so good for me. It feels like home. Everyone knows I had a tough year at Celtic. So, you know, he sounds like, for now anyway, he feels like he's kind of reborn as a player. As to whether Brighton intend to use him this season or intend to get rid of him in the next 2 weeks, I suppose we're going to see. But it's good to see him back and actually playing well in the Premier League in a winning performance for his team. So it turns out that Lampard actually does, he genuinely does feel that sorry for himself. To send him out into the Premier League, expecting him to get results with this squad, with this group of players. Like, the fact is, he looks at that squad, and in his head, all he can hear is, this is his exquisite self-pity. Timo Werner, like Timo Werner. Imagine.
That's one for the players. Players have to take the responsibility because the message was clear.
Did he bring the players in? Did he bring the Germans in?
And then Jody Morris is like, boss, you know, what are we going to do? And he's like, he breaks out of this dreamy. But like, can you believe that they're doing to Lampard?
It's the first football pod of a new season. I think I've forgotten what our football analysts sound like. John Broome, give us a shot of that golden voice of yours. How are you?
Hello, Owen. How are you?
Oh, beautiful. You sound very formal for the opening one of the season. Richie, how are you?
How are you, lads? There's no other way I can say hello.
It's the catchphrase at this age. I love it. Both sounding good. Both excited about what you saw at the weekend, Richie, particularly with the fans back.
Yeah, it was amazing. Honestly, it was like watching games where I'd never seen the impact of fans before, where I wasn't aware of just how better and more meaningful and more memorable any match can be if you fill the stadium with thousands and thousands of people who really care what happens on the pitch. The Brentford game on Friday night was just... Yeah. I had a hell of a weekend. My wife was away and I had no other plans, and I was of a bit of a back injury at the moment, so I just plotted up all weekend. Watched as much football as I could. It was joyous.
I'm sorry to hear about the back injury, Richie, but I'm glad you had the football to keep you going. The Brentford one in particular, was that the most, in terms of the fan impact, was that the one that hit you the hardest?
I think it was a lot of things watching that match. I mean, I think most Premier League fans probably only take an interest in a club when they get to the Premier League, and they might read some articles in the summer before they start. Before a newly promoted team gets involved and find out something about their history. But I obviously would have, when I was in England and playing in England, Brentford were lower league club. They were at Millwall's level the whole time. I remember playing in the old ground, very small, very compact. Like, nothing about it back then would have said, you know, one day these are going to be at Premier League level. But there were so many aspects to it. Like, the players collectively were all making their Premier League debut. They hadn't played at that level before. It was the first time we saw the manager at that level. It was the first time the stadium not only had hosted a Premier League game, but the first time the stadium had been full because of the pandemic. And there was loads of little moments. There was the like the manager's brilliant. Like I hope we've no reason to ever criticize this fella over the season, but it, like, he was G'ing up the fans, and there was the minute round of applause for the former director of football who died in the 28th minute, and the fans were olaying like passes among the Brentford players as early as I think a half an hour. And the place obviously went bonkers when the couple of goals went in, and singing Hey Jude. And there were so many, even the connecting moments after the game, the manager with a little girl doing a selfie with a little young fan as well. And even the players giving interviews afterwards, Canos even mentioning specifically his two uncles being in the crowd. And that kind of hit me a little bit as well. It's gone, Jesus, imagine playing in England as a foreigner, which obviously I was, with no family ever there at any matches. Forget about no fans being there, but never having to share any of your memories with your fans, where, or with your family, where it's simply ringing them on the phone or sending them over footage that you don't actually have to ever share a moment. And I thought little things like that, just, it set me up for the weekend. I thought, this is great.
John, what stood out for you over the weekend?
I'd say one thing. I'd forgotten about this. And in a way, it left me feeling slightly bereft, because during pandemic football, we had this scheduling where football was on all weekend, where, you know, obviously we had the Friday night game anyway. But, and it's good because as someone who works a shift pattern, I really did not miss that Saturday night fixture or the late Sunday night fixture. Or on Monday, then there's no Monday night football this week, where you have that those games played in the 5:30 neighbours and home and away slot. instead, you had that five matches at once being played in the Premier League on Saturday. Jeff Stelling and the lads revved up. It felt like I was going back in time. Now, there is some argument over whether those matches should be shown at 3 p.m. in the UK. We don't have the privilege, of course, of Owen McDevitt presenting Crystal Palace every week. But, yeah, it you know, with the fans in the stadium, it felt like a reunion. Now, at this point, can I serve a note of caution? And I'm not a zero COVID guy or anything like that, but...
Go on, Dr. Doom.
Yeah, but no, just from the friends of mine that attended matches... The footage inside, you know, concourses and that did not look a COVID-safe environment. And when we consider the rise in the figures that the Euros brought for essentially one or two matches, okay, pubs and that were included, I wouldn't be surprised to see some sort of knock-on effect from that. But let's set that aside. We almost have to live with that. Having fans in the stadium, and I think what Richie said... Brentford kicked it off so well, great atmosphere, and Thomas Frank has already guaranteed himself a spot on the Premier League years documentary for this season with a bravura performance, and we look forward to far more of that.
Well, the surprise result, I guess, was, I mean, if you don't consider Brentford beating Arsenal to be that much of a surprise, was probably Tottenham beating Manchester City, John, and a game where I thought, wow, I wouldn't have expected this, but it looks as though Man City need Harry Kane a lot more than Tottenham do.
Well, we can all look on this game and think, can we expect this? But don't Manchester City have a habit of losing games 1-0, in which they start games very well, blind the opposition with science and interchanging positions, and then concede a goal and find no way back into the game? This is a recurring pattern. And as you say... a good striker might solve that. But are we seeing, and this is a prediction way ahead of itself, are we seeing the end of the Pep Guardiola empire?
They're breaking the transfer record. I mean, that, you know, there's clearly confidence in Pep, judging by the way that the club is spending. They've broken the transfer record once. It looks like they're probably going to do it again. I mean, that doesn't seem like a club that's preparing to push the button on its manager.
Well, no, I mean, the thing is, though, Pep Guardiola, there isn't a safer managerial position, you would suggest, in European football than Pep and Manchester City. But those signings, okay, Harry Kane, It is
which signing which hasn't happened yet. But,
yes, of
but
course. But yeah. That's the one, and I don't like this phrase, but you know, it's very common in England, the no brainer, and and then Jack Grealish seems to be another no brainer, but I don't really get it, and I don't really get the fee. Now the comparison was made actually the other day, and I thought this was valid, to when they signed Riyad Mahrez. Now Riyad Mahrez, if you recall, it was 5 years ago, was probably the best player in the Premier League in the 2015-16 season, you know, give or take Vardy and Kante.
He won the Football Writers Award, did he? Yeah, I think...
Jamie Vardy won the Football Writers and...
Mahrez won PFA?
Yes, okay. Yes. And but I don't think Jack Grealish has ever reached the heights that Mahrez did that season. Now, OK, he was probably playing he's definitely playing in a lesser team. There is this talk that both Grealish and Harry Kane, should he sign, are players that Pep wants because he's liked them when he's seen them play. Now, we've seen this before in Pep's career, where he's liked certain players and then decided to sign them. The Ukrainian guy, forgive my pronunciation, was it Truginski?
Truginski, the defender of Barcelona, yeah. 12 years ago.
Yeah, he was an absolute disaster. And there are, you know, Alexis Sanchez would be another. I'm not sure that Pep's... This is the issue, isn't it, with Pep, that a great manager, delivers results, if not Champions Leagues, for 10 years. But with new signings, I'm not sure he's ever... his transfer dealings are not of the highest grade, you would say. And I'm not sure... that he's often improved players. Now, Mahrez, I think, actually is pretty good for Manchester City these days, but he is not the barnstorming player that we saw at Leicester. And I, in that, okay, it was 90 minutes or whatever, I watched that and I just wasn't sure where Jack Grealish is going to fit into that team. And in combination with Benjamin Mendy, well, there was clearly a weak point for Tottenham to pick at there, wasn't there?
Yeah, I felt that as well, Richie, watching Grealish, sort of scratching my head. What are you supposed to be doing here? It's kind of hard to work out. And that's one of the reasons I started to think, wow, they really need Kane just to provide some... Or, you know, another centre forward. It doesn't have to be Harry Kane, but a centre forward. I mean, obviously, they've got rid of Aguero, who Pep never really seemed to like, but the little man... He always scored 2 goals in every 3 games, regular as clockwork, which is a useful attribute to have in your team. Gabriel Jesus hasn't scored at that type of rate, so they do have a centre forward, but he's as far as I can make out, pretty much the only one. Now, the reason why I think they need a centre forward, even though Pep doesn't always play with one, is to provide a little bit of structure for the players on the field. Like, I know that Guardiola's teams have had great success playing without strikers at times. But oftentimes that the team in question has had Lionel Messi playing as a false nine, in which case, okay, that kind of covers a lot of your bases. You know, but when you're trying to bring a new player like Grealish in, I think when a team that's trying to play without a striker, it requires a lot of complicated movements from all of the players who have to kind of go into the box. They have to go in and out and in and out of the box. Several players. And I think it can be quite difficult for a guy who's new to this, like Grealish, to get the hang of it. I mean, I don't know what you think about this. What do you think Grealish is going to end up doing for this team?
No, I think you're right. But I that phrase, complicated movements, that's what I associate with Pep. I think more than most managers, like some you can think of, well, you can imagine they let the forward players just go and play, get in the ball and create something. That's exactly the opposite of the approach that Pep has. It's all coordinated movements, and there's a lot of work on into where players need to be and link up plays and interplays and all that kind of stuff. So it, like any player going into any Pep team, like you're going to take time to be coached and to fit in. And in addition, like there are loads of similar type players. I don't know if Grealish is exactly the answer. The phrase I'm thinking of, I don't think Grealish makes City that much better than Kane arriving would improve City, if you know what I mean. But I think, like Pep said, was asked beforehand, I think was it Jeff Reeves? I don't know who it was. He said, you know, what do we expect from Grealish, or what are you hoping from him? And Pep gave the kind of answer that I would think is the right one. He said, we've signed this fella for years. So I'm paraphrasing now, but he said, he might hit the ground running, he might not. It might take him a little bit of time, it might not. But we've got time here, and we're going to put a lot of work into this fella. And so we're not worried about him hitting the ground running straight away. So I think there's going to be a huge amount of focus on him because of the fee, because of his profile, because of how the Euros went, because he's English. All of those things aren't going to go away. But I think if you add Harry Kane to that lineup, like, and include a fully fit Kevin De Bruyne, who wasn't fully available from the start yesterday, came on towards the end. Foden, who wasn't in the squad at all. And then you chuck in, like, if Sterling can recover the form he had a good while ago, or depending on what you get from Mahrez, like, I know he can only play 11 of them, but there's a hell of a squad there that he can choose from. So I wouldn't be as quick as John is to write off Pep as a manager or City as a force just yet. Not after one game of the opening weekend.
Ah, John's trying to make an impact early doors. You know, get tongues wagging.
It's more than Jack Grealish did. So
no, Richie, I'm looking at your Twitter timeline here, and am I to take it that you have not been impressed with Harry Kane's behaviour in the last couple of weeks?
I'll couch this a little bit, but we're going, obviously, we don't know for sure what he's thinking or what was behind some of his decisions. But I think a player being unhappy with his situation or wanting his situation to change, great. Like, most players have experienced that at one point. Or being at a club where you want to leave, or you're at odds with what the manager wants from you, or what the club's ambitions for themselves are. Loads of reasons why a player would want to leave, but I think you definitely cross a line in my mind if one of the strategies you deploy is, I'm going to refuse to show up training. Now, there's been a couple of mentions. Graham Souness, really interestingly, yesterday on Sky, just made some reference to the fact that he knew the story and that we shouldn't assume that Kane was simply refusing to show up for training.
Yeah, we played a clip earlier. He has this information. There's another story going on behind the scenes.
Now, I've been in the studios before where we're aware of the backstory to maybe why a player hasn't showed up for an international squad, to why a manager and a player don't work well with one another, why a certain player is never in a team, or why another player always is. And sometimes you're privy to something which you know you just can't say on air, but then you just use that information to decide, okay, well, let's not bring attention to this issue because we can't explain the reasons behind it. But for Souness to kind of tease us a little bit with the information, so let's hold the possibility that there's something we don't know about that completely justifies Harry Kane's decision not to be in that training ground for a few days. I don't know what it is. I can't imagine what it is. But what I've noticed is Tottenham didn't seem to be aware of Kane's reasons. When he didn't show up, it broke in the news, Kane isn't training today. And, you know, sources say Tottenham are angered, Tottenham don't know. And then Kane releases a statement saying it was always the plan, which doesn't really say anything. Like, was it your plan? Was it just your intention? Did you communicate it to anyone else? What was the reasons behind it? Did Tottenham know? What was their feelings about it? So he's done something which for me is crossing a line. Like, you can give a manager, you can give an interview criticizing your manager. You can have a blazing row with your manager face to face. You can absolutely hammer the directors to their face. I've seen or been involved in loads of those conversations over the years. But when you refuse to show up training and you say, well, I'm not playing any part in the preparations for this season, such as my determination to leave or my disgust with the idea of staying, that I'm going to hit the nuclear button here and I'm not actually going to even show up. And I'm not even going to tell you why I'm not showing up or tell you in advance that I'm not going to. I think that definitely, that makes him a very unsympathetic character in my mind in this story. Almost at one point, I'm like rooting for Daniel Levy, a sentence I'd never thought I'd say before. But I think when you refuse to show up training and you stay away like that, I think that for me just puts you in a whole other category.
Well, you know, if it works, maybe Harry Kane has shoved away to all the players in the future who want to escape from...
That's why I'm so strong in this, because I don't want it to work. Because I don't want that to be established as a strategy that we all turn it. Do you know, like, penalty kick, you go down, whatever, and we go, well, in fairness, you know, he's got the penalty kick. And we've kind of wandered into this scenario where the end justifies the means, and which is fine. We're all guilty of that. But then when you start saying a player can decide not to show up for training, because in fairness, we know that the club's response is going to be they'll buckle and give you what you want. Like, that can't be a scenario that we, that is workable, first of all, but it surely isn't a scenario any of us should be promoting or accepting. So it's, I think, because he's used this strategy, it's why I want the outcome to be the one that Daniel Levy is most happy with rather than Harry Kane.
I mean, what do you think about that, John? You know, there is this thing out of the Kane camp, which is that Daniel Levy supposedly agreed to, you know, play ball. He supposedly said, oh, you know, look, I know the contract says 6 years, but in reality, you can go after three, or, you know, that there had been a so-called gentleman's agreement. And, you know, maybe if say, for instance, that was the case, if that really was true, and then Levy reneged on that, then maybe Harry Kane is entitled to go all scorched earth.
Yeah, I think I'm more on Rich's side of things, though not to say that I'd be the biggest fan of Daniel Levy either. But
I don't think any of us are.
Well, yeah, well, exactly. Yeah, listen, he's a decent operator. He's done okay, but you know, maybe there were those that were on his side. Anyway, someone said this to me the other day, was that Harry Kane is a big fan of US sports. Now, we know this, don't we? Because he's, one of his ambitions is to actually play in the NFL. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
And there is this idea that he is following the negotiation patterns of several US sports stars, in which when they're negotiating their contracts, that they do this, the holdout method. And that this is how he's trying to extract himself from Tottenham. I don't think that's something that flies, certainly in English football. And I think that Harry Kane, a player that most people would think was a pretty solid citizen, watching the TV yesterday, everybody of the pundits group was saying that, you know, this guy's never really put a foot wrong. He's a top professional. You know, there's no off-field issues. But I do think that in the way that they've handled this, and there was that message a couple of weeks ago, they've left things a bit open, a bit opaque, a bit, you know, left it sort of mercurial and whispers against Daniel Levy without, as Richie said, without actually coming out and saying, this is what we want. That we actually want to leave Tottenham. They've never actually said that this is the intent. And I do think that Harry Kane probably needs to show the courage of his convictions, if that's what he really wants. Maybe he might get a lesser fee out of Manchester City because he's decided that he wants away and he'll lose a loyalty bonus or whatever it is. I mean, I wouldn't be too aware of the contractual issues there. But as it stands, it's just left this rather sort of foul-smelling air. And Tottenham should be celebrating the fact that they beat last season's champions, and yet we're talking about Harry Kane. And they've got a new manager in charge who's done a very good job in winning that game, but we're still talking about Harry Kane. That's not a good vibe.
I think the idea, sorry, I think the notion there that there's a possible like verbal agreement or a handshake or a nod and a wink or some kind of a gentleman's agreement, I hear that phrase as well, that this is being hung on, I think just smacks of, I don't know how to describe that, because I think, do the people involved not realise, first of all, that there's a reason that people sign contracts, or there's a reason people spend a hell of a lot of time negotiating on the finer details around things like release clauses? So if you're signing a 6-year deal, as is the case here, and you think, well, it's very possible at some point here that the club's trajectory won't match mine, and at some point, if my career goes the way I want it to, I'm going to want to leave. So you predict that outcome in advance and you put down the objective criteria that have to be written down. So it's not subjective, it's not open to interpretation. If the club failed to reach the Champions League or if I do certain performance things at my end, whatever happens, or if there's an offer from a certain club, here's what needs to click in, and if it does, I'm off. Now, I haven't read any reports that there's a release clause in his deal. Now, if you sign a six-year contract with no release clauses and the person you're negotiating with is Daniel Levy and you have any passing understanding of how he does business in the past, then I'm sorry, the fault is on you. And then if you're going to sit there, again, I haven't heard Kane say this publicly, but if Kane is sitting in a sitting room somewhere going, you know, we had a deal. Daniel told me that day after that match in the players' lounge that night that, you know, Harry, you're a great lad. You can go in the summer if things work out. And you're hanging that. You're hanging this whole strategy on the fact that it was a comment. Well, like, how long have you been in professional football? Like, why do you think what is said in a conversation supersedes everything that's written down and was spent months and months and huge amount of agent fees or lawyer's fees or negotiating hours to get something written in a contract? That's when you do your work. You don't, like, get a fella to agree to something when there is or isn't witnesses and nothing is written down. So that's just... I don't know why there would be such an emphasis placed on a possible gentleman's agreement. But actually, just one other point I wanted to make on the thing about not showing up for training. If we were to allow that to creep in, or if anyone was at any point to say, well, do you know what, I understand that as a strategy, and that we were allowed a scenario where this becomes acceptable. Like, contracts are two-way. The club pays you on one end and you on the other end, you show up and do your job. Now, if we're going to allow a scenario where if there's a breakdown in the relationship between a club and a player, their ambitions no longer match one another and they want to separate. If we're okay with players not doing their end and simply not showing up, well then, does that mean we're paving the way for any club at any time to decide, well, we're not going to do our end, we're not going to stop paying certain players. And it's not going to be the elite players that are going to stop getting paid. It's not going to be the ones who are wearing the armband or who are potentially going to be sold for 100 or 150 million. It's all going to the squad players or the long-term injured lads or the ones out of favour or the ones who are too old. So we've got to hold on to the idea that what's in a contract matters, and the players can't just decide whether he's an LFM fan or not, or whether the strategy is deemed to be one that will work or not. You can't have a scenario where players can choose not to do their job because they simply want to move clubs.
Well, the other part of that exchange that we mentioned between Mike Richards and Graeme Souness involved Paul Pogba. And I thought, you know, Mike Richards made this interesting point, which I've seen lots of people make on Twitter. Everyone's saying Harry Kane is a saint, whereas Pogba's getting absolute pelters. And I thought, well, is he? Like, I'm not aware of that happening at the moment with Paul Pogba, who, as we know, is in the last year of his contract. And played brilliantly against Leeds in Man United's 5-1 win, John. 4 assists, which means he's already got one more than he had in all of last season. And he got 3 goals and 3 assists. I see Miguel Delaney has a story today that PSG are willing to pay Paul Pogba €600,000 a week from the start of the 2022-23 season as they seek to ensure his signing by expanding rivals. So that story suggests that they've earmarked him as their next mega money free transfer. Do you think that Pogba's brilliant performance which continues on, I have to say, some of his form from the European Championships, maybe reflects the sense of freedom around a player who can finally see light at the end of the tunnel now with that €600,000 offer? Or do you think he has a longer term future at Man United?
I'd be minded to go along with my friend's story there. If that's true, why would Manchester United aren't going to be able to offer him £600,000 a week or to live in Paris. So you would suggest that, yeah, that there was something to Pogba's demeanour, the way that he played, that suggested, yeah, there is light at the end of the tunnel. There is freedom ahead on his, you know, mere £350,000 a week, whoever it is he's getting paid at United. He played very well, didn't he? Him and Bruno Fernandes in tandem, in the way that many people envisaged, and hasn't really worked out too much in the time they've been together. I think there was a game at Fulham last season when that did work. But we've talked about Pogba so much over the years. I think that when he does depart United at the end of this season, I can't really see him negotiating to stay. He will be remembered as the great enigma that didn't quite work out twice over, of course, because he was at the club previously.
Seriously, on the Mike Richards point, do you get that sense that he's been criticised a lot? I mean, I'm not sure.
I don't really know. Listen,
I mean, he has been over the years, but if you compare Pogba and Harry Kane, you know, I would say that Harry Kane has been a lot more consistent for his team.
Yes,
than Pogba has for his.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, Mike's assertion that Harry Kane is not getting pelters doesn't seem to work, because he has been getting pelters from, well, all of us here, in fact. I imagine Harry Kane listens every week to Second Captains, but Pogba, no. I mean, I think actually there's almost an acceptance that this is the way it's going to go, and you know, United fans have pretty much split down the middle on Pogba. Some hope that one day he will turn into the great player that they expected him to be. Some want rid of him, and then there are those who would probably share my point of view, which is, you know, enjoy him while you can. Let's hope he can produce something this season. And I wouldn't be surprised if he produced a good season for United.
What about the performances of the team in general, John? I mean, to top of the league, looking good, confident. If you've already written Man City off after one game, are you writing Manchester United in as title winners?
Well, it was Leeds who they beat 6-2 last season, whose style of play is ideal for the Ole Gunnar Solskjaer plan. And I was quite surprised how lax Leeds were, and actually didn't look as fit as I might expect. But listen, that's the thing about Ollie at United. When it clicks, it can be fairly spectacular, because he's got all those attacking players. And when, you know, in Bruno Fernandes, you've got, you know, United's best goal scoring midfielder since Brian Robson or something like that. And there's so much to be excited about. I mean, Luke Shaw was excellent in that game, just as he was during the Euros. And Mason Greenwood, the latest young player off the production line, who looks the real deal already. And, you know, there's talk this season that he is going to learn off Edinson Cavani, but he looks like he could be not far off the finished article already. I mean, as a finisher, I mean, the goal that he scored, it's all there, isn't it? And he had a up and down season last season, and obviously there was the, you know, the Iceland trip and all that type of thing. But yeah, United look great, you know, the last time I remember them starting a season like that was back in 2006-07 when they destroyed Fulham and got off to a great start, which was not always the way. Even in the Ferguson years, he almost liked to start slowly, didn't he? Until the points total that you had to get was higher. Yeah, United fans are entitled to enjoy that. Beating Leeds 5-1 on the first day of the season, don't get much better than that, really.
Richie, Liverpool fans are entitled to enjoy their performance as well. Salah looking good. Scored. Did they say he's the first player, I think, in Premier League history to score on the opening day of the season in 5 consecutive seasons. Virgil van Dijk is back. I don't know if he looked back to his best yet or not. I don't know what you think about that.
Look, they're going to have tougher fixtures this season than away against Norwich. I think the big boost for them is to see Van Dijk back. Salah is continuing the ridiculous numbers and consistency that he's performed for ages. And they won that game without, I don't think Fabinho was involved. Henderson didn't start. Obviously, Robertson is injured. I heard a lot of your conversations last week about trying to get lads to predict who'd finish where and what to expect from certain teams. I don't know if I'm not sitting here expecting Liverpool to be champions in the summer. They may have a decent title push. I don't expect them to drop to the depths that they did for spells last season, but I don't think they're going to be able to sustain a challenge to overtake Chelsea or City to be champions this season. But to get Van Dijk back, I don't think there's much transfer business left to be done, is there? I don't think Liverpool are probably what they have is what they're going to have. Is that right?
Looks that way.
Yeah, so I don't think, like, with City, obviously a huge thing is will Kane arrive or not, and Chelsea have Lukaku who's coming in, and United have Sancho, we don't know what he's going to produce, and Varane coming in. So, like, we'll assume what Liverpool have is what they're going to go into the season with, and I don't know if it's going to be enough to be champions.
All right, just lastly, Richie, the Dubs. It's all over.
Do you know I had a ticket? I had two tickets to it.
Yeah.
Because of my feckin' back, I knew I wouldn't be able to walk to the stadium or sit in the seats for ages. So I lay in my bed and watched it.
Don't suppose you could have, your back would have let you pick up the phone and get on to, you know, one of your friends, say, oh, you know, I've got a couple of spare tickets for that
one of
game.
Your friends living quite close to the stadium, is that what you're saying, Ken?
Oh, I'm saying, you know.
Well, listen, the tickets didn't last long in my hands, Ken. It went unused. They went, but yeah, the empire has fallen.
Empire's fallen. That back injury has done you a lot of good. You managed to avoid that and watch loads of football. So long may that back hold you up, Richie. Thanks a million. Thanks, John. Great stuff.
Cheers, lads.
Off to bed I went. My head was fried.
I didn't even know there was a damn card in the thing.
Fucking
horror. I was
horror.
Devastated.
I'd been off the smokes a while.
Hard fuck.
Saw that. Back on there. I had a date organised for that night. A first date with someone. Cancelled that. My head was gone.
Woke up the following morning and to my absolute amazement, I read this message on my phone.
Let me tell you, you're only getting this because you're a former player of mine, and I'm not too sure too many journalists would have got the third time lucky.
Hi Richie, sorry the equipment didn't work again, but it's no problem for me to do it again. Maybe see you in Ipswich one day for third time lucky. Best wishes, Mick. Best wishes, Mick.
I got a job on the Wednesday. I'd been a player up until that Wednesday. Took the training on Thursday. I picked the team on Friday and I took the game on Saturday. So I got the job on the Wednesday. It was a bit of a whirlwind.
Oh, God. Oh, Jesus.
Well, I'm just looking down. I think all the red lights are still on. It looks like we've recorded this successfully. Mick, thank you so much for agreeing to do this so many times.
Richie, I sincerely hope so, because there's no fourth time lucky, let me tell you.
John Bruin mentioned my beloved Crystal Palace there, covering them on TV the other day. Bad news for all you Eagles out there. I don't think this thing's going to work out under Patrick Vieira. I don't. I'm not sure about Vieira. Whoa.
Why not?
Well, so, you know, you're researching it in advance and you're looking at how he did. Did all right in MLS. You know, he seemed to leave with fairly good wishes from his club in America. Went over to Nice. Didn't really work out there. And Richard Dunn follows the football in France a lot. And he was saying, like, there's a lot of criticism for essentially not really having a philosophy. You know, when you were watching it, yes, I was watching highlights afterwards, and they were saying, oh, he obviously wants to play football and he wants an attacking philosophy and stuff. But apparently really just changed the whole time there when things were going wrong, and the players didn't really know what was going on. And that seems to be the criticism of him. And he was, you know, sacked after losing 5 games in a row in the middle of last season. So it's not like they've signed, you know, it's not like he's shown as a manager so far that he's definitely good. And then he gave a pre-match interview whereas he was asked about his philosophy and he was just so vague. I know you can't judge him on that, but it was like, well, what we want to do is we want the players to give 100% for the club, and then we've got to find the tactics that will have a solid at the back, and then we also want to score goals, you know? And you're like, I'm not, you know, I just think if Thomas Tuchel's being interviewed, he's probably giving you a bit more than that. But listen, Vieira's not Tuchel. It's more of an old school thing where it's a manager and legendary ex-player who is getting these jobs, you know, partly based on that name, but has also gone around. He's done his time. He's done the Man City Academy. He's gone to America. He's gone to France. He's now in the Premier League. I wish him well as basically a Crystal Palace fan now. But yeah, I'm just not 100% convinced yet.
And didn't he say something like after the game, yeah, you know, we're still waiting to get a few players in? I think he said something like that. And I thought, it's not really what you want to say. Like, I mean, that's the best people haven't turned up yet. Yeah. You know? But, you know, it'll all be different when, you know, I don't have to play these chumps. Yeah.
What can I do with these lads?
Which is not obviously what he said, but it is the implication of what he said. So
seems like a very nice man. I'd like it to go well for him. So I'll hold fire for now, but just.
I've seen him on the training ground, of course.
New York.
New York City FC.
You had amazing days, I recall, at your visit to
New York. I just remember you got very windburned.
No, I got sunburned, Owen. I got horribly sunburned.
With actual sun, okay.
Yeah, it's my face has never recovered from it. It was really? Like April. Yeah, it was like mid-April or something like that. And I went out up to the City University of New York campus, which where New York City FC were playing, in the hope of maybe grabbing a word with manager Patrick Vieira. This was when they had David Villa, Andrea Pirlo, and the guy who I ended up speaking to, Tommy McNamara, wasn't it? I think it was Tommy McNamara. That was, you know, I wanted Vieira. They offered McNamara. So I said, okay, you know, he's kind of Irish. There was at the time Ireland speculation. So I thought, well, you know, there's some local, you know, I can ask him what he thinks of Ireland. And so I went up. But would you believe that the New York City FC, I was expecting at least there to be a building, right? But there wasn't. It was just a fucking pitch surrounded by like a fence, and there was nothing. They had no facility. It was they have no, you know, trap. They have no the Tribune. They have no the locker room. They have no the building. It was like the City University of New York, which is kind of north of New York City, kind of in the northern suburbs of New York City. They were just using like one of their pitches as a training ground. So the players would all arrived on a bus late, got out, did some training, then just got back on the bus. There was no showers or anything. Like, they were obviously showering at some other location. Anyway, but the point was that it was quite a sunny April, you know, one of those very clear, sunny April days. There was never any thought of sunburn in my head as I got my train up into the northern suburbs of New York. But as I was standing on the side of this training ground, I sort of started to think, Jesus, this is quite a intense sunshine. I hope I'm okay. But it was by the time I was, I think, back in New York with you guys, my nose had gone completely red. And like, actually this, it had melted. Yeah, it was like melted cheese.
It was bad.
It was like when cheese melts in a microwave and starts to bubble and sort of, that was what my skin was like, my nose. And it's never been the same since, Owen. I'm glad to be able to tell you about this. It's never been the same. I said goodbye to my old nose that day. What did Patrick Vieira do? He boomed out a lot of instructions on the training ground. He made the players go through some tough physical drills. But disappointingly, from my point of view, he chewed out Tommy McNamara for his apparently inept positioning at some set piece practice, and he chewed him out in front of the whole squad, such that 5 minutes later, when Tommy McNamara had to stop to do the interview with me, he was like trembling with, I don't know if it was anger, humiliation, some type of strong emotion that made him tremble and also made him rather incoherent and uncommunicative. And so I don't know if we ever played that very short interview with Tommy McNamara. I wish,
you know,
well.
I don't think we did get
no, I think we abandoned it. So I gave my nose in the cause of service for nothing. Just, it was for nothing. It was completely in vain. I lost it in vain. But that's journalism.
Look, if that Tommy Mac interview is still on tape somewhere,
Someone's got it in their email.
More football through the week and right through the season on the World Service. You can sign up on secondcaptains.com. Like I said earlier, there's no minimum contract, but beyond the first month,
you gotta sign up, baby.
We'll be back later today to trash out this Mayo ending of the Dubs era. That podcast's gonna be free to all. Thanks, Murph. Thank you, Polite Ken.
Thank you, Owen, and thank you, Kieran.
Thanks, new Ken. Thanks, same old Owen.
Thanks, everyone. Take care.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's the persuasion of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.